The town is buzzing with reports that Mashugana Edward was flying around Malastrana with the devil. Naturally, I assumed you were involved.
This time Rabbi Lowe's tone held a note of gentle reproof.
Gabriel, Gabriel, what will your father say? That I should have dropped him, no doubt. My father has little patience with creatures like Edward Kelly. You mean madmen?
I meant what I said, Maharal, Matthew said evenly.
The man you talk so easily about killing is, alas, the only person who can help you find your wife's book.
Rabbi Lowe stopped, considered his words.
But do you truly want to know its secrets? Life and death are great responsibilities.
Given what I am, you will not be surprised that I'm familiar with their particular burdens.
Matthew's smile was humorless.
Perhaps. But can your wife also carry them? You may not always be with her, Gabriel. Some who would share their knowledge with a witch will not do so with you.
So there is a maker of spells in the Jewish town, I said. I wondered when I heard about the golem.
He has been waiting for you to seek him out. Alas, he will see only a fellow witch. My friend fears Gabriel's congregation, and with good reason.
Rabbi Lowe explained. I would like to meet him, Rabbi Lowe. There were precious few weavers in the world. I couldn't miss the opportunity to know this one. Matthew stirred, a protest rising to his lips. This is important, Matthew. I rested my hand on his arm. I promised Goody Alsop not to ignore this part of me while we're here.
One should find wholeness in marriage, Gabriel, but it shouldn't be a prison for either party, said Rabbi Lowe.
This isn't about our marriage or the fact that you're a witch. Matthew rose, his large frame filling the room. It can be dangerous for a Christian woman to be seen with a Jewish man. When I opened my mouth to protest, Matthew shook his head.
Not for you. For him.
You must do what Rabbi Lowe tells you to do. I don't want him or anyone else in the Jewish town to come to harm. Not on our account.
I won't do anything to bring attention to myself, or to Rabbi Lowe, I promised.
Then go and see this weaver. I'll be in the Ungelt, waiting.
Matthew brushed his lips against my cheek and was gone before he could have second thoughts. Rabbi Lowe blinked.
Gabriel is remarkably quick for one so large, the rabbi said, getting to his feet. He reminds me of the Emperor's tiger.
Cats do recognize Matthew as one of their kind, I said, thinking of Sarah's cat Tabitha.
The notion that you've married an animal does not distress you. Gabriel is fortunate in his choice of wife.
Rabbi Lowe picked up a dark robe and called to his servant that we were leaving. We departed in what I supposed was a different direction, but I couldn't be sure, since all my attention was focused on the freshly paved streets, the first I'd seen since arriving in the past. I asked Rabbi Lowe who had provided such an unusual convenience.
Herr Meisel paid for them, along with a bathhouse for the women. He helps the Emperor with small financial matters, like his holy war against the Turks.
Rabbi Lowe picked his way around a puddle. It was then that I saw the golden ring stitched onto the fabric over his heart.
What is that? I said, nodding at the badge.
It warns unsuspecting Christians that I am a Jew.
Rabbi Lowe's expression was wry.
I have long believed that even the dullest would eventually discover it, with or without the badge. But the authorities insist that there can be no doubt.
Rabbi Lowe's voice dropped.
And it is far preferable to the hat the Jews were once required to wear. Bright yellow and shaped like a chess piece. Just try to ignore that in the market.
That's what humans would do to me and Matthew if they knew we were living among them. I shivered. Sometimes it's better to hide.
Is that what Gabriel's congregation does? It keeps you hidden?
If so, then they're doing a poor job of it, I said with a laugh. Frau Huber thinks there's a werewolf prowling around the stag moat. Your neighbors in Prague believe that Edward Kelly can fly. Humans are hunting for witches in Germany and Scotland,
and Elizabeth of England and Rudolf of Austria know all about us. I suppose we should be thankful that some kings and queens tolerate us.
Toleration is not always enough. The Jews are tolerated in Prague, for the moment, but the situation can change in a heartbeat. Then we would find ourselves out in the countryside, starving in the snow.
Rabbi Lo turned into a narrow alley and entered a house identical to most other houses in most of the other alleys we passed through. Inside, two men sat at a table covered with mathematical instruments, books, candles, and paper.
"Astronomy will provide a common ground with the Christians," one of the men exclaimed in German, pushing a piece of paper toward his companion.
He was around 50, with a thick gray beard and heavy brow bones that shielded his eyes. His shoulders had the chronic stoop of most scholars.
"Enough, David," the other exploded. "Maybe common ground is not the promised land we hope for." "Abraham, this lady wishes to speak with you,"
Rabbi Lo said, interrupting their debate.
"All the women in Prague are eager to meet Abraham."
David, the scholar, stood.
"Whose daughter wants a love spell this time?"
"It is not her father that should interest you, but her husband. This is Frau Reuden, the Englishman's wife."
"The one the Emperor calls La Diosa?"
David laughed and clasped Abraham's shoulder.
"Your luck has turned, my friend. You are caught between a king, a goddess, and a Nachzerer."
My limited German suggested this unfamiliar word meant devourer of the dead. Abraham said something rude in Hebrew, if Rabbi Lo's disapproving expression was any indication, and turned to face me at last. He and I looked at each other, witch to witch, but neither of us could bear it for long. I twisted away with a gasp, and he winced and pressed his eyelids with his fingers. My skin was tingling all over, not just where his eyes had fallen, and the air between us was a mass of different, bright hues.
"Is she the one you were waiting for, Abraham ben Elijah?"
Rabbi Lo asked.
"She is," Abraham said.
He turned away from me and rested his fists on the table.
"My dreams did not tell me that she was the wife of an Aluka, however."
"Aluka?" I looked to Rabbi Lo for an explanation. If the word was German, I couldn't decipher it.
"A leech. It is what we Jews call creatures like your husband," he replied. "For what it is worth, Abraham, Gabriel consented to the meeting." "You think I trust the word of the monster who judges my people from his seat on the Kahal, while turning a blind eye to those who murder them?" Abraham cried.
I wanted to protest that this was not the same Gabriel, the same Matthew, but stopped. Something I said might get everyone in this room killed in another 6 months, when the 16th century Matthew was back in his rightful place. "I am not here for my husband or the congregation," I said, stepping forward. "I'm here for myself."
"Why?" Abraham demanded.
"Because I too am a maker of spells, and there aren't many of us left."
"There were more, before the Kahal. The congregation set up their rules," Abraham said, a challenge in his tone. "God willing, we will live to see children born with these gifts."
"Speaking of children, where is your golem?" I asked. David guffawed.
"Mother Abraham, what would your family in Helm say?"
"They would say I had befriended an ass with nothing in his head but stars and idle fancies, David Gans," Abraham said, turning red.
My fire drake, which had been restive for days, roared to life with all this merriment. Before I could stop her, she was free. Rabbi Lo and his friends gaped at the sight. "She does this sometimes. It's nothing to worry about." My tone went from apologetic to brisk as I reprimanded my unruly familiar. "Come down from there." My fire drake tightened her grip on the wall and shrieked at me. The old plaster was not up to the task of supporting a creature with a 10-foot wingspan. A large chunk fell free, and she chattered in alarm. Her tail lashed out to the side and anchored itself into the adjacent wall for added security. The firedrake hooted triumphantly. "If you don't stop that, I'm going to have Galloglass give you a really evil name," I muttered.
Does anyone see her leash? It looks like a gauzy chain.
I searched along the skirting boards and found it behind the kindling basket, still connected to me.
Can one of you hold the slack for a minute while I rein her in?
I turned, my hands full of translucent links. The men were gone.
Typical, I muttered. 3 grown men and a woman, and guess who gets stuck with the dragon?
Heavy feet clomped across the wooden floors. I angled my body so that I could see around the door. A small, reddish-gray creature wearing dark clothes and a black cap on his bald head was staring at my fire drake.
No, Yosef!
Abraham stood between me and the creature, his hands raised as if he were trying to reason with it. But the golem... For this must be the legendary creature fashioned from the mud of the Moldau and animated with a spell, kept moving his feet in the fire drake's direction.
Yosef is fascinated by the witch's dragon, said Davit. I believe the golem shares his maker's fondness for pretty girls, Rabbi Lo said. My reading suggests that a witch's familiar often has some of his maker's characteristics.
The golem is Abraham's familiar?
I was shocked.
Yes. He didn't appear when I made my first spell. I was beginning to think I didn't have a familiar.
Abraham waved his hands at Yosef, but the golem stared unblinking at the firedrake sprawled against the wall. As if she knew she had an admirer, the firedrake stretched her wings so that the webbing caught the light. I held up my chain.
Didn't he come with something like this?
That chain doesn't seem to be helping you much, Abraham observed.
I have a lot to learn, I said indignantly.
The firedrake appeared when I wove my first spell. How did you make Yosef? Abraham pulled a rough set of cords from his pocket.
With ropes like these.
I have cords too. I reached into the purse hidden in my skirt pocket for my silks.
Do the colors help you to separate out the world's threads and use them more effectively?
Abraham stepped toward me, interested in this variation of weaving.
Yes. Each color has a meaning, and to make a new spell, I use the cords to focus on a particular question.
I looked at the golem in confusion. He was still staring at the fire drake.
But how did you go from cords to a creature?
A woman came to me to ask for a new spell to help her conceive. I started making knots in the rope while I considered her request, and ended up with something that looked like the skeleton of a man.
Abraham went to the desk, took up a piece of Davit's paper, and, in spite of his friend's protests, sketched out what he meant.
It looks like a poppet, I said, looking at his drawing. 9 knots were connected by straight lines of rope, a knot for its head, one for its heart, 2 knots for hands, another knot for pelvis, 2 more for knees, and finally 2 for the feet.
I mixed clay with some of my own blood and put it on the rope like flesh. The next morning, Yosef was sitting by the fireplace.
You brought the clay to life, I said, looking at the enraptured golem. Abraham nodded.
A spell with the secret name of God is in his mouth. So long as it remains there, Yosef walks and obeys my instructions, most of the time. Yosef is incapable of making his own decisions, Rabbi Lo explained. Breathing life into clay and blood does not give a creature a soul, after all. So Abraham cannot let the golem out of his sight for fear Yosef will make mischief. I forgot to take the spell out of his mouth one Friday when it was time for prayers, Abraham admitted sheepishly. Without someone to tell him what to do, Yosef wandered out of the Jewish town and frightened our Christian neighbors. Now the Jews think Yosef's purpose is to protect us.
A mother's work is never done, I murmured with a smile. Speaking of which... My fire drake had fallen asleep and was gently snoring, her cheek pillowed against the plaster. Gently, so as not to irritate her, I drew on the chain until she released her grip on the wall. She flapped her wings sleepily, became as transparent as smoke, and slowly dissolved into nothingness as she was absorbed back into my body.
I wish Yosef could do that,
Abraham said enviously. And I wish I could keep her quiet by removing a piece of paper from under her tongue, I retorted. Seconds later, I felt the sense of ice on my back.
Who is this? Said a low voice.
The new arrival was not large or physically intimidating, but he was a vampire, one with dark blue eyes set into a long, pale face under dusky hair. There was something commanding about the look he gave me, and I took an instinctive step away from him.
It is nothing that concerns you, Herr Fuchs, Abraham said curtly.
There is no need for bad manners, Abraham.
Rabbi Lowe's attention turned to the vampire.
This is Frau Reuden, Herr Fuchs. She has come from Malastrana to visit the Jewish town.
The vampire fixed his eyes on me, and his nostrils flared just as Matthew's did when he was picking up a new scent. His eyelids drifted closed. I took another step away.
Why are you here, Herr Fuchs? I told you I would meet you outside the synagogue, Abraham said, clearly rattled.
You were late.
Herr Fuchs's blue eyes snapped open and he smiled at me.
But now that I know why you were detained, I no longer mind.
Herr Fuchs is visiting from Poland, where he and Abraham knew each other,
Rabbi Lowe said, finishing his introductions. Someone on the street called out in greeting.
Here is Herr Meisel, Abraham said.
He sounded as relieved as I felt. Herr Meisel, provider of paved streets and fulfiller of imperial defense budgets, broadcast his prosperity from his immaculately cut woolen suit, his fur-lined cape, and the bright yellow circle that proclaimed him a Jew. This last was affixed to the cape with golden thread, which made it look like a nobleman's insignia rather than a mark of difference.
There you are, Herr Fuchs.
Herr Meisel handed a pouch to the vampire.
I have your jewel.
Meisel bowed to Rabbi Lowe and to me.
Frau Reuden?
The vampire took the pouch and removed a heavy chain and pendant. I couldn't see the design clearly, though the red and green enamel were plain. The vampire bared his teeth.
Thank you, Herr Meisel.
Fuchs held up the jewel, and the colors caught the light.
The chain signifies my oath to slay dragons, no matter where they're found. I've missed wearing it. The city is full of dangerous creatures these days.
Herr Meisel snorted.
No more than usual.
And leave the city's politics alone, Herr Fuchs. It will be better for all of us if you do so. Are you ready to meet your husband, Frau Reuden? He is not the most patient of men.
Herr Meisel will see you safely to the Ungelt,
Rabbi Lowe promised.
He leveled a long look at Herr Fuchs.
See Diana to the street, Abraham. You will stay with me, Herr Fuchs, and tell me about Poland.
Thank you, Rabbi Lowe.
I curtsied in farewell.
It was a pleasure, Frau Reuden.
Rabbi Lowe paused.
And if you have time, you might reflect on what I said earlier. None of us can hide forever.
No. Given the horrors the Jews of Prague would see over the next centuries, I wished he were wrong. With a final nod to Herr Fuchs, I left the house with Herr Meisel and Abraham.
A moment, Herr Meisel, Abraham said when we were out of earshot of the house.
Make it quick, Abraham, Herr Meisel said, withdrawing a few feet.
I understand you're looking for something in Prague, Frau Reuden. A book.
How do you know that?
I felt a whisper of alarm.
Most of the witches in the city know it, but I can see how you're connected to it. The book is closely guarded, and force will not work to free it.
Abraham's face was serious.
The book must come to you, or you will lose it forever.
It's a book, Abraham. Unless it sprouts legs, we're going to have to go into Rudolph's palace and fetch it.
I know what I see, Abraham said stubbornly. The book will come to you, if only you ask for it. Don't forget.
I won't, I promised. Herr Meisel looked pointedly in our direction.
I have to go. Thank you for meeting me and introducing me to Yosef.
May God keep you safe, Diana Royden, Abraham said solemnly, his face grave.
Herr Meisel escorted me the short distance from the Jewish town to the old town. Its spacious square was thronged with people. The twin towers of Our Lady of Teen rose to our left, while the stolid outlines of the town hall crouched to our right.
If we didn't have to meet Herr Royden, we would stop and see the clock strike the hours, Herr Meisel said apologetically. You must ask him to take you past it on your way to the bridge. Every visitor to Prague should see it.
At the Ungelt, where the foreign merchants traded under the watchful eyes of the customs officer, the merchants looked at Meisel with open hostility.
Here is your wife, Herr Royden. I made sure she noticed all the best shops on her way to meet you. She will have no problem finding the finest craftsmen in Prague to see to her needs and those of your household.
Meisel beamed at Matthew.
Thank you, Herr Meisel. I'm grateful for your assistance and will be sure to let His Majesty know of your kindness. It is my job, Herr Royden, to see to the prosperity of His Majesty's people. And it was a pleasure too, of course, he said. I took the liberty of hiring horses for your journey back. They're waiting for you near the town clock.
Meisel touched the side of his nose and winked conspiratorially.
You think of everything, Herr Meisel, Matthew murmured. Someone has to, Herr Royden, responded Meisel.
Back at the Three Ravens, I was still taking my cloak off when an 8-year-old boy in a flying mop practically knocked me off my feet. The mop was attached to a lively pink tongue and a cold black nose.
What is this? Matthew bellowed, steadying me so that I could locate the mop's handle.
His name is Libero. Galloglass says he will grow into a great beast, and that he might as well have a saddle fitted for him as a leash. Annie loves him too. She says he will sleep with her, but I think we should share. What do you think?
Jack said, dancing with excitement.
The wee mop came with a note, Galloglass said.
He pushed himself away from the doorframe and strolled over to Matthew to deliver it.
Need I ask who sent the creature? Matthew said, snatching at the paper. Oh, I don't think so, Galloglass said. His eyes narrowed. Did something happen while you were out, Auntie? You look done in.
Just tired, I said with a breezy wave of my hand. The mop had teeth as well as a tongue, and he bit down on my fingers as they passed by his as-yet undiscovered mouth.
Ouch!
This has to stop!
Matthew crushed the note in his fingers and flung it to the floor. The mop pounced on it with a delighted bark. What did the note say? I was pretty sure I knew who had sent the puppy.
Ich bin Libero. Ich will euch aus dem Schatten der Nacht zu schützen,
Matthew said flatly. I made an impatient sound. Why does he keep writing to me in German? Rudolf knows I have a hard time understanding it.
His Majesty delights in knowing I will have to translate his professions of love.
Oh. I paused. What did this note say?
I am Libero. I will protect you from the shadow of night.
And what does Libero mean? Once, many moons ago, Isabeau had taught me that names were important.
It means wolf hunter in Spanish, Auntie.
Galloglass picked up the mop.
This bit of fluff is a Hungarian guard dog. Libero will grow so big he'll be able to take down a bear. They're fiercely protective and nocturnal.
A bear! When we bring him back to London, I will tie a ribbon around his neck and take him to the bear baiting so that he can learn how to fight,
Jack said with the gruesome delight of a child.
Libero is a brave name, don't you think? Master Shakespeare will want to use it in his next play.
Jack wriggled his fingers in the puppy's direction, and Galloglass obligingly deposited the squirming mass of white fur in the boy's arms.
Annie, I will feed Libero next.
Jack pelted up the stairs, holding the dog in a death grip.
Shall I take them away for a few hours? Galloglass asked after getting a good look at Matthew's stormy face.
Is Baldwin's house empty?
There are no tenants in it, if that's what you mean.
Take everybody.
Matthew lifted my cloak from my shoulders.
Even Lobero?
Especially Lobero.
Jack chattered like a magpie throughout supper, picking fights with Annie and managing to send a fair bit of food Lobero's way through a variety of occult methods. Between the children and the dog, it was almost possible to ignore the fact that Matthew was reconsidering his plans for the evening. On the one hand, he was a pack animal, and something in him enjoyed having so many lives to take care of. On the other hand, he was a predator, and I had an uneasy feeling that I was tonight's prey. The predator won. Not even Teresa and Carolina were allowed to stay.
Why did you send them all away?
We were still by the fire in the house's main first-floor room, where the comforting smells of dinner still filled the air.
What happened this afternoon? He asked.
Answer my question first.
Don't push me. Not tonight, Matthew warned.
You think my day has been easy?
The air between us was crackling with blue and black threads. It looked ominous and felt worse.
No.
Matthew slid his chair back.
But you're keeping something from me, Diana. What happened with the witch?
I stared at him.
I'm waiting.
You can wait until hell freezes over, Matthew, because I'm not your servant. I asked you a question.
The threads went purple, beginning to twist and distort.
I sent them away so that they wouldn't witness this conversation. Now what happened?
The smell of cloves was choking.
I met the golem, and his maker, a Jewish weaver named Abraham. He has the power of animation, too.
I told you I don't like it when you play with life and death.
Matthew poured himself more wine. You play with them all the time, and I accept that as part of who you are. You're going to have to accept it's part of me, too.
And this Abraham? Who is he?
Matthew demanded. God, Matthew, you cannot be jealous because I met another weaver.
Jealous? I am long past that warm-blooded emotion.
He took a mouthful of wine. Why was this afternoon different from every other day we spend apart while you're out working for the congregation and your father?
It's different because I can smell every single person you've been in contact with today. It's bad enough that you always carry the scent of Annie and Jack. Galloglass and Pierre try not to touch you, but they can't help it. They're around you too much. Then we add the scents of the Maharal and Herr Meisel and at least two other men. The only scent I can bear to have mixed with yours is my own, but I cannot keep you in a cage, so I endure it the best I can.
Matthew put down his cup and shot to his feet in an attempt to put some distance between us. That sounds like jealousy to me.
It's not. I could manage jealousy, he said, furious. What I am feeling now, this terrible gnawing sense of loss and rage because I cannot get a clear impression of you in the chaos of our life, is beyond my control.
His pupils were large and getting larger.
That's because you're a vampire. You're possessive, it's who you are, I said flatly, approaching him in spite of his anger.
And I am a witch. You promised to accept me as I am, light and dark, woman and witch, my own person as well as your wife. What if he had changed his mind? What if he wasn't willing to have this kind of unpredictability in his life?
I do accept you.
Matthew reached out a gentle finger and touched my cheek. No, Matthew. You tolerate me because you think that one day I'll beat my magic into submission. Rabbi Lo warned me that tolerance can be withdrawn, and then you're out in the cold. My magic isn't something to manage, it's me. And I'm not going to hide myself from you. That's not what love is.
All right. No more hiding.
Good. I sighed with relief, but it was short-lived. Matthew had me out of the chair and up against the wall in one clean move, his thigh pressed between mine. He pulled a curl free so that it trailed down my neck and onto my breast. Without releasing me, he bent his head and pressed his lips to the edge of my bodice. I shivered. It had been some time since he'd kissed me there, and our sex life had been practically non-existent since the miscarriage. Matthew's lips brushed along my jaw and over the veins of my neck. I grabbed his hair and pulled his head away. Don't. Not unless you plan on finishing what you start. I've had enough bundling and regretful kisses to last a lifetime. With a few blindingly fast vampire moves, Matthew had loosened the fastenings on his breeches, rucked my skirts around my waist, and plunged inside me. It wasn't the first time I'd been taken against the wall by someone trying to forget his troubles for a few precious moments. On several occasions, I'd even been the aggressor.
This is about you and me. Nothing else. Not the children, not the damn book, not the Emperor and his gifts. Tonight the only sense in this house will be ours.
Matthew's hands gripped my buttocks, and his fingers were all that was saving me from being bruised as his thrusts carried my body toward the wall. I wrapped my hands in the collar of his shirt and pulled his face toward mine, ravenous for the taste of him. But Matthew was no more willing to let me control the kiss than he was our lovemaking. His lips were hard and demanding, and when I persisted in my attempts to get the upper hand, he gave me a warning nip on the lower lip.
Oh God, I said breathlessly, as his steady rhythm set my nerves rushing toward a release.
Oh.
Tonight I won't even share you with him.
Matthew kissed the rest of my exclamation away. One hand retained its grip on my buttock, the other dipped between my legs.
Who has your heart, Diana? Matthew asked,
a stroke of his thumb threatening to take me over the edge of sanity. He moved again.
Waited for my answer. Say it, he growled.
You know the answer, I said. You have my heart.
Only me, he said, moving once more so that the coiled tension in both of us finally found release.
Only. Forever. You,
I gasped, my legs shaking around his hips. I slid my feet to the floor.
Matthew was breathing heavily, his forehead pressed to mine. His eyes showed a flash of regret as he lowered my skirts. He kissed me gently, almost chastely. Our lovemaking, no matter how intense, hadn't satisfied whatever was driving Matthew to keep pursuing me, in spite of the fact that I was indisputably his. I was beginning to worry that nothing could. My frustration burbled over, taking shape in a concussive wave of air that carried him away from me and into the opposite wall. Matthew's eyes went black at his change of position.
And how was that for you, my heart? I asked softly.
His face registered surprise. I snapped my fingers, releasing the air's hold on him. His muscles flexed as he regained his mobility. He opened his mouth to speak.
Don't you dare apologize, I said fiercely. If you'd touched me in a way I didn't like, I would have said no.
Matthew's mouth tightened. I can't help thinking about your friend, Giordana Bruno. Desire urges me on as fear bridles me. I'm not afraid of your power or your strength or anything else about you, I said. What are you afraid of, Matthew? Regretful lips brushed over mine. That and a whisper of breeze against my skirts told me he had fled rather than answer.
Chapter 30. Master Habermel stopped by. Your compendium is on the table.
Matthew didn't look up from the plans to Prague Castle that he'd somehow procured from the Emperor's architects. In the past few days, he'd given me wide berth and taken to channeling his energy into unearthing the secrets of the palace guard so that he could breach Rudolph's security. In spite of Abraham's advice, which I'd duly conveyed, Matthew preferred a proactive strategy. He wanted us out of Prague. Now. I approached his side, and he looked up with restless, hungry eyes. It's just a gift. I put down my gloves and kissed him deeply. My heart is yours, remember?
It isn't just a gift. It came with an invitation to go hunting tomorrow.
Matthew wrapped his hands around my hips. Galloglass informed me that we will be accepting it. He's found a way into the Emperor's apartments by seducing some poor maid into showing him Rudolph's erotic picture collection. The palace guard will either be hunting with us or napping. Galloglass figures it's as good a chance as we're going to get to look for the book.
I glanced over at Matthew's desk, where another small parcel lay. Do you know what that is, too? He nodded and reached over and picked it up.
You're always receiving gifts from other men. This one is from me. Hold out your hand.
Intrigued, I did what he asked. He pressed something round and smooth into my palm. It was the size of a small egg. A stream of cool, heavy metal flowed around the mysterious egg as tiny salamanders filled my hand. They were made of silver and gold, with diamonds set into their backs. I lifted one of the creatures, and up came a chain made entirely of paired salamanders, their heads joined at the mouth and their tails entwined. Still nestled in my palm was a ruby. A very large, very red ruby.
It's beautiful.
I looked up at Matthew.
When did you have time to buy this?
It wasn't the kind of chain that goldsmiths stocked for drop-in customers.
I've had it for a while, Matthew confessed. My father sent it with the altarpiece. I wasn't sure you'd like it.
Of course I like it. Salamanders are alchemical, you know, I said, giving him another kiss. Besides, what woman would object to 2 feet of silver, gold, and diamond salamanders and a ruby big enough to fill an egg cup?
These particular salamanders were a gift from the king when I returned to France in late 1541. King Francis chose the salamander in flames for his emblem, and his motto was, I nourish and extinguish.
Matthew laughed.
Kit enjoyed the conceit so much he adapted it for his own use. What nourishes me destroys me.
Kit is definitely a glass-half-empty demon, I said, joining in his laughter. I poked at one of the salamanders, and it caught the light from the candles. I started to speak, then stopped.
What? Matthew said.
Have you given this to someone before? After the other night, my own sudden insecurity was embarrassing.
No, Matthew said, taking my hand and its treasure between his.
I'm sorry. It's ridiculous, I know, especially considering Rudolph's behavior. I'd rather not wonder, that's all. If you give me something you once gave to a former lover, just tell me.
I wouldn't give you something I'd first given to someone else, mon coeur.
Matthew waited until I met his eyes.
Your fire drake reminded me of Francis's gift, so I asked my father to fish it out of its hidey hole. I wore it once. Since then it's been sitting in a box.
It's not exactly everyday wear, I said, trying to laugh. But it didn't quite work. I don't know what's wrong with me.
Matthew pulled me down into a kiss. My heart belongs to you no less than yours belongs to me. Never doubt it.
I won't.
Good. Because Rudolph is doing everything he can to wear us both down. We need to keep our heads. And then we need to get the hell out of Prague.
Matthew's words came back to haunt me the next afternoon, when we joined Rudolph's closest companions at court for an afternoon of sport. The plan had been to ride out to the Emperor's hunting lodge at White Mountain to shoot deer, but the heavy gray skies kept us closer to the palace. It was the second week of April, but spring came slowly to Prague, and snow was still possible. Rudolph called Matthew over to his side, leaving me to the mercy of the women of the court. They were openly curious and entirely at a loss about what to do with me. The Emperor and his companions drank freely from the wine that the servants passed. Given the high speeds of the impending chase, I wished there were regulations about drinking and riding. Not that I had much to worry about in Matthew's case. For one thing, he was being rather abstemious, and there was little chance of him dying, even if his horse did crash into a tree. Two men arrived, a long pole resting on their shoulders to provide a perch for the splendid assortment of falcons that would be bringing down the birds this afternoon. Two more men followed, bearing a single hooded bird with a lethal curved beak
and brown feathered legs that gave the effect of boots. It was huge.
Ah, Rudolf said, rubbing his hands together with delight. Here is my eagle, Augusta. I wanted La Diosa to see her, even though we cannot fly her here. She requires more room to hunt than the stag moat provides.
Augusta was a fitting name for such a proud creature. The eagle was nearly 3 feet tall and, though hooded, held her head at a haughty angle. She can sense that we are watching her, I murmured. Someone translated this for the Emperor, and he smiled at me approvingly.
One huntress understands another. Take her hood off. Let Augusta and La Diosa get acquainted.
A wizened old man with bowed legs and a cautious expression approached the eagle. He pulled on the leather strings that tightened the hood around Augusta's head and gently drew it away from the bird. The golden feathers around her neck and head ruffled in the breeze, highlighting their texture. Augusta, sensing freedom and danger both, spread her wings in a gesture that could be read either as the promise of imminent flight or as a warning. But I was not the one Augusta wanted to meet. With unerring instinct, her head turned to the only predator in the company more dangerous than she was. Matthew stared back at her gravely, his eyes sad. Augusta cried out in acknowledgement of his sympathy.
I did not bring Augusta out to amuse Herr Roiden, but to meet La Diosa.
Rudolf grumbled. And I thank you for the introduction, Your Majesty, I said, wanting to capture the moody monarch's attention.
Augusta has taken down 2 wolves, you know, Rudolf said with a pointed look at Matthew.
The Emperor's feathers were far more ruffled than those of his prize bird.
They were both bloody struggles.
Were I the wolf, I would simply lie down and let the lady have her way, Matthew said lazily.
He was every inch the courtier this afternoon in a green and gray ensemble, his black hair pushed under a rakish cap that provided little protection from the elements, but did provide an opportunity to display a silver badge on its crown, the de Clermont family's Ouroboros, lest Rudolf forget with whom he was dealing. The other courtiers smirked and tittered at his daring remark. Rudolf, once he had made sure the laughter was not directed at him, joined in.
It is another thing we have in common, Herr Roiden, he said, pounding on Matthew's shoulder.
He surveyed me.
Neither of us fears a strong woman.
The tension broke. The falconer returned Augusta to her perch with some relief, and asked the Emperor which bird he wished to use for this afternoon to take down the royal grouse.
Rudolf fussed over his selection.
Once the Emperor chose a large gerfalcon, the Austrian archdukes and German princes fought over the remaining birds until only a single animal was left. It was small and shivering in the cold. Matthew reached for it.
That is a woman's bird,
Rudolf said with a snort, settling into his saddle.
I had it sent for La Diosa.
In spite of her name, Diana doesn't like hunting. But it's no matter. I will fly the Merlin, Matthew said.
He ran the jesses through his fingers, put out his hand, and the bird stepped onto his gloved wrist.
Hello, beauty, he murmured while the bird adjusted her feet.
With every small step, her bells jingled.
Her name is Sharka, the gamekeeper whispered with a smile. Is she as clever as her namesake? Matthew asked him.
More so, the old man answered with a grin.
Matthew leaned toward the bird and took one of the strings that held her hood in its teeth. His mouth was so close to Sharka, and the gesture so intimate, that it could have been mistaken for a kiss. Matthew drew the string back. Once that was done, it was easy for him to remove the hood with his other hand and slip the decorated leather blindfold into a pocket. Sharka blinked as the world came into view. She blinked again, studying me and then the man who held her. Can I touch her? There was something irresistible about the soft layers of brown and white feathers.
I wouldn't. She's hungry. I don't think she gets her fair share of kills, Matthew said.
He looked sad again, even wistful. Sharka made low, chortling sounds and kept her eyes on Matthew. She likes you.
It was no wonder.
They were both hunters by instinct, both fettered so that they couldn't give in to the urge to track and kill. We rode on a twisting path down into the river gorge that had once served as the palace moat. The river was gone, and the gorge fenced in to keep the Emperor's game from roaming the city. Red deer, roe deer, and boar all prowled the grounds. So too did the lions and other big cats from the menagerie on those days when Rudolf decided to hunt down his prey with them rather than birds. I expected utter chaos, but hunting was as precisely choreographed as any ballet. As soon as Rudolf released his gerfalcon into the air, the birds resting in the trees rose up in a cloud, taking flight to avoid becoming a snack. The gerfalcon swooped down and flew over the brush, the wind whistling through the bells on his feet. Startled grouse erupted from cover, running and flapping in all directions before taking to the air. The gerfalcon banked, selected a target, harried it into position, and shot forward to hit it with talons and beak. The grouse fell from the sky, the falcon pursuing it relentlessly to the ground, where the grouse, startled and injured, was finally killed. The gamekeepers released the dogs and ran with them across the snowy ground. The horses thundered after, the men's cries of triumph drowned out by the baying of the hounds. When the horses and riders caught up, we found the falcon standing by its prey, its wings curved to shield the grouse from rival claimants. Matthew had adopted a similar stance at the Bodleian Library, and I felt his eyes fall on me to make sure that I was nearby. Now that the Emperor had the first kill, the others were free to join in the hunt. Together, they caught more than 100 birds, enough to feed a fair number of courtiers. There was only one altercation. Not surprisingly, it occurred between Rudolf's magnificent silver gerfalcon and Matthew's small brown and white merlin. Matthew had been hanging back from the rest of the male pack. He released his bird well after the others and was unhurried in claiming the grouse that she brought down. Though none of the other men got off their mounts, Matthew did, coaxing Sharka away from her prey with a murmured word and a bit of meat that he'd pulled off a previous kill. Once, however, Sharka failed to connect with the grouse she was pursuing. It eluded her, flying straight into the path of Rudolf's gerfalcon. But Sharka refused to yield. Though the gerfalcon was larger, Sharka was scrappier and more agile. To reach her grouse, the merlin flew past my head so closely that I felt the changing pressure in the air. She was such a little thing, smaller even than the grouse, and definitely outsized by the Emperor's bird. The grouse flew higher, but there was no escape. Sharka quickly reversed direction and sank her curved talons into her prey, her weight carrying them both down. The indignant gerfalcon screamed in frustration, and Rudolf added his own loud protest.
"Your bird interfered with mine,"
Rudolf said furiously as Matthew kicked his horse forward to fetch the merlin.
"She isn't my bird, Your Majesty," Matthew said.
Sharka, who had puffed herself up and stretched out her wings to look as large and menacing as possible, let out a shrill peep as he approached. Matthew murmured something that sounded vaguely familiar and more than a little amorous, and the bird's feathers smoothed.
"Sharka belongs to you. And today she has proved to be a worthy namesake of a great Bohemian warrior."
Matthew picked up the merlin, grouse and all, and held it up for the court to see. Sharka's jesses swung freely, and her bells tinkled with sound as he circled her around. Unsure what their responses should be, the courtiers waited for Rudolf to do something. I intervened instead.
"Was this a female warrior, husband?"
Matthew stopped in his rotation and grinned.
"Why, yes, wife. The real Sharka was small and feisty, just like the Emperor's bird, and knew that a warrior's greatest weapon lies between the ears."
He tapped his head to make sure everyone received the message. Rudolf not only received it, he looked nonplussed.
"She sounds rather like the ladies of Malastrana," I said dryly. "And what did Sharka do with her intelligence?"
Before Matthew could answer, an unfamiliar young woman spoke.
"Sharka took down a troop of soldiers," she explained in fluent Latin with a heavy Czech accent. A white-bearded man I took to be her father looked at her approvingly, and she blushed.
Really? I said, interested. How?
By pretending she needed rescuing, and then inviting the soldiers to celebrate her freedom with too much wine. Another woman, this one elderly, with a beak of a nose to rival Augusta's, snorted in disgust. Men fall for that every time. I burst out laughing. To her evident surprise, so did the beaky, aristocratic old lady.
I fear, Emperor, that the ladies will not have their heroine blamed for the faults of others.
Matthew reached into his pocket for the hood and gently set it over the crown of Sharka's proud head. He leaned in and tightened the cord with his teeth. The gamekeeper took the Merlin to a smattering of approving applause. We adjourned to a red-and-white-roofed Italianate house set at the edge of the palace grounds for wine and refreshments, though I would have preferred to linger in the gardens where the Emperor's narcissi and tulips were blooming. Other members of the court joined us, including the sour-faced Strada, Master Hufnagel, and the instrument-maker Erasmus Habermel, whom I thanked for my compendium.
What we need to lift our boredom is a spring feast now that Lent is almost over,
said one young male courtier in a loud voice.
Don't you think so, Your Majesty?
A mask?
Rudolph took a sip of his wine and stared at me.
If so, the theme should be Diana and Actaeon.
That theme is so common, Your Majesty, and rather English, Matthew said sadly. Rudolph flushed. Perhaps we might do Demeter and Persephone instead. It is more fitting for the season.
Or the story of Odysseus, Strada suggested, shooting me a nasty look. Frau Royden could play Circe and turn us into piglets.
Interesting, Ottavio,
Rudolph said, tapping his full lower lip with his index finger.
I might enjoy playing Odysseus.
Not on your life, I thought. Not with the requisite bedroom scene and Odysseus making Circe promise not to forcibly take his manhood.
If I might offer a suggestion, I said, eager to stave off disaster.
Of course,
Rudolph said earnestly, taking my hand and giving it a solicitous pat. The story I have in mind requires someone to take the role of Zeus, the king of the gods, I told the Emperor, drawing my hand gently away.
I would be a convincing Zeus, he said eagerly, a smile lighting his face. And will you play Callisto?
Absolutely not. I was not going to let Rudolph pretend to ravage and impregnate me.
No, Your Majesty. If you insist that I take part in the entertainment, I will play the goddess of the moon.
I slid my hand into the bend of Matthew's arm, and to atone for his earlier remark, Matthew will play Endymion.
Endymion?
Rudolph's smile wavered. Poor Rudolph. Outfoxed again, Matthew murmured for only me to hear.
Endymion, Your Majesty, he said, this time in a voice pitched to carry, the beautiful youth who is cast into enchanted sleep so as to preserve his immortality and Diana's chastity.
I know the legend, Herr Royden,
Rudolph warned. Apologies, Your Majesty, Matthew said with a graceful, albeit shallow, bow. Diana will look splendid, arriving in her chariot so that she can gaze wistfully upon the man she loves. Rudolph was imperial purple by this point. We were waved out of the royal presence and left the palace to make the brief downhill trip to the Three Ravens.
I have only one request, Matthew said as we entered our front door. I may be a vampire, but April is a cold month in Prague. In deference to the temperature, the costumes you designed for Diana and Endymion should be more substantial than a lunar crescent for your hair and a dishcloth to drape around my hips.
I've only just cast you in this role, and you're already making artistic demands.
I flung up one hand in mock indignation.
Actors!
That's what you deserve for working with amateurs, Matthew said with a smile. I know just how the mask should begin. And lo, from opening clouds I saw emerge the loveliest moon that ever silvered o'er, a shell for Neptune's goblet.
You cannot use Keats.
I laughed. He's a romantic poet. It's 300 years too soon.
She did soar, so passionately bright, my dazzled soul. Commingling with her argent spheres did roll, through clear and cloudy, even when she went, at last, into a dark and vapory tent, he exclaimed dramatically, pulling me into his arms.
And I suppose you'll want me to find you a tent, Galloglass said, thundering down the stairs.
And some sheep, or maybe an astrolabe. Endymion can be either a shepherd or an astronomer, Matthew said, weighing his options.
Rudolph's gamekeeper will never part with one of his strange sheep, Galloglass said dourly.
Matthew is welcome to use my compendium. I looked around. It was supposed to be on the mantelpiece, out of Jack's reach. Where is it gone?
Annie and Jack are showing it to Mop. They think it's enchanted.
Until then, I hadn't noticed the threads running straight up the stairs from the fireplace, silver, gold, and gray. In my rush to reach the children and find out what was going on with the compendium, I stepped on the hem of my skirt. By the time I reached Annie and Jack, I'd managed to give the bottom a new scalloped edge. Annie and Jack had the little brass and silver compendium opened up like a book, its inner wings folded out to their full extent. Rudolph's desire had been to give me something to track the movements of the heavens, and Habermel had outdone himself. The compendium contained a sundial, a compass, a device to compute the length of the hours at different seasons of the year, an intricate lunar vavel, whose gears could be set to tell the date, time, ruling sign of the zodiac and phase of the moon, and a latitude chart that included, at my request, the cities of Roanoke, London, Lyon, Prague, and Jerusalem. One of the wings had a spine into which I could fit one of the hottest new technologies, the erasable tablet, which was made of specially treated paper that one could write on and then carefully wipe off to make fresh notes.
Look, Jack, it's doing it again, Annie said, peering down at the instrument.
Mop, no one in the house called him Libero anymore except for Jack, started barking,
wagging his tail with excitement as the lunar vavel began to spin of its own accord.
I bet you a penny that the full moon will be in the window when the spinning stops, Jack said, spitting in his hand and holding it out to Annie.
No betting, I said automatically, crouching down next to Jack. When did this start, Jack? Matthew asked, fending off Mop.
Jack shrugged.
It's been happening since Herr Habermel sent it, Annie confessed.
Does it spin like this all day or only at certain times? I asked.
Only once or twice, and the compass just spins once.
Annie looked miserable.
I should have told you. I knew it was magical from the way it feels.
It's all right. I smiled at her. No harm done. With that, I put my finger in the center of the vavel and commanded the thing to stop. It did. As soon as the revolution ceased, the silver and gold threads around the compendium slowly dissolved, leaving only the gray thread behind. It was quickly lost among the many colorful strands that filled our house.
What does it mean? Matthew asked later.
When the house was quiet and I had my first opportunity to put the compendium out of the children's reach, I'd decided to leave it atop the flat canopy over our bed.
By the way, everybody hides things on top of the tester. It will be the first place Jack searches for it.
Somebody is looking for us. I pulled the compendium back down and sought out a new place to conceal it.
In Prague?
Matthew held out his hand for the small instrument, and when I handed it to him, he slipped it into his doublet.
No.
In time. Matthew sat down on the bed with a thunk and swore. It's my fault.
I looked at him sheepishly.
I tried to weave a spell so that the compendium would warn me if somebody was thinking of stealing it. The spell was supposed to keep Jack out of trouble. I guess I need to go back to the drawing board.
What makes you think it's someone in another time? Matthew asked.
Because the lunar vavel is a perpetual calendar.
The gears were spinning as though it were trying to input information beyond its technical specifications. It reminds me of the words racing around in Ashmole 782.
Maybe the whirring of the compass indicates that whoever is looking for us is in a different place, too. Like the Lunar Vault.